From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour could be made at a public forum in any local municipality, one like Rochester. And during the meeting, attendees discussed the future of the city's abandoned roadways. Some suggest adding green spaces to make the area safe and more accessible to children. Others hope new pathways will be added to increase the walkability of neighborhoods. Each person gets a chance to share their thoughts and voice their concerns. Instead of government leaders making the decisions for them, community members have a chance to propose plans that best fit their interests. This is the type of conversation that our guest is hoping to see in cities across the United States. Everyday people from small neighborhoods making active decisions about the infrastructure in their own cities. Xinpei Tai is the Director of Policy, Cities, and Transportation at Uber and is the Executive Director of the Gale Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to providing data about the transformation of public spaces. She believes that when the public has a chance to design and develop common spaces like walkways or bus stops, neighbors become more engaged in public discourse and the growth of their own city. So what would happen if Rochester took on this approach, especially when it comes to making decisions about transportation? And how can Rochester and other cities create a sustainable future by adopting a multimodal system? Xinpei will answer those questions next week when she's in town for a presentation with the Community Design Center's Reshaping Rochester series. But first, she is joining us right here on Connection. Xinpei, welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you? Glad to be here.
Very good. And also with us in studio, Maria Fergiuelli is the Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Hello to Jason Partika, who's a member of Reconnect Rochester. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And Julie Boese is Director of Service Planning at RTS. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
All right, Maria, next week, next Wednesday is your next event. That's the 26th of February. What's going on?
That's great. We have our lecture presentation with Xinpei's visit at 6 o'clock at Gleason Works Auditorium, where we've always had it. New this year is we're having a open to the public meet and greet right across the street at the 40 and A Club, the building with the flagpole. So please come join us. You can talk to us or her and have a great time.
All right. That's what time again? 6 o'clock.
The presentation is at 6.
6 p.m. at Gleason Works next Wednesday, a sustainable urban future through transportation. And I want to start, Xinpei, by asking you very directly about city size, because you know, whether you're in San Francisco, New York City, I mean, so many cities are seeing change or obviously already have structured their own like mini ecosystems and societies in ways that allow for different kinds of transportation. Here in Rochester, you know, smaller to mid-sized cities, can we reasonably expect to see a real transformation anytime soon?
Well, I think the short answer is yes. And there's lots of different ways of doing it. And if you think about, you know, the first innovation in technology, the car, and how that was universally applied across every kind of city, big or small. I mean, even the smallest main streets had to be redesigned to accommodate the car. I think we're really entering a different kind of design and planning phase right now, where we're able to have, we have a lot of different other tools in our toolkit and can think about more tactical phased approaches, more multimodal approaches, and have a better understanding of all the different needs in a city, even small cities.
What's step one for a city like Rochester that doesn't have, you know, beyond RTS and beyond, you know, buses, there's not a subway line here, there's not streetcars. What is step one toward moving into that future as you see it, Xinpei?
I think take a really good look at your assets and be pretty honest, but also generous to the city. I think many cities overlook their historical assets, where the neighborhoods are, where the kind of backbone of where people are. I think it's fabulous that you have buses. Buses are the most flexible form of public transportation you can have. And then, you know, there's a lot of new different ways of tackling all the other services that might be asked for by the people living in the city. So there's, you know, look at where people are working, look at where people are living, look at where the destinations are, and really think about that experience of the person trying to travel through the city and how to make it as easy as possible for that person.
Let me ask Julie to kind of weigh in on that subject of buses. We're going to talk to Bill Carpenter soon on this program about some of the vision of RTS for the future. How much change is happening right now at RTS with how it's addressing the needs of this community?
There's a lot of change happening right now. It's the most change that's happened in the last 40 or 50 years that the bus system has been around. So, you know, talking about different modes, like we have those buses, but we've always had those 40 and 60 foot buses. And starting in June now, we're actually moving into this whole new time of smaller vehicles, smaller buses, vans, on-demand service that's not running on a fixed route schedule. So, you know, RTS is expanding the different types of mobility that we offer, you know, just in the interest of trying to bring some of these new things into this community.
Do you see a community supporting RTS and using RTS the way you'd like it to be right now?
I think that there's some room for improvement. I think that what we've found, you know, we've gone out into the community a lot in the past couple of years trying to get input on this new plan as we've developed it. And what we kind of already knew, but what we heard reinforced was that, you know, in some ways the bus system wasn't as convenient for people as they wanted it to be, and that more people potentially would be using it if that was something that we could accomplish. And so, you know, obviously there's always constraints due to funding, but within those constraints, we've tried really hard to reallocate things in a way that is going to make that bus system and those smaller vehicles a lot more convenient for people to use, and to try to expand the usefulness in a way that is going to get more people in the community to be able to use it in ways that fit into their life.
All right, so let's talk about not just busing, let's talk about bicycling, let's talk about different forms of transportation. Shinpei, let me start with you on this, and if you could, give me a vision of what, let's kind of go ahead a quarter century. Cities like Rochester, doesn't have to be Rochester, but just sort of mid-size American cities. What's it look like when you are moving through that city compared to what it is now? What are the notable changes?
Well, it's really great to hear about the shared mobility applications that are already in place, and I think you're just going to see more and more of that. I think the biggest transformation, I believe, are two things. One is a bike lane network or a slow lane network, in the sense of, or maybe it's a carbon zero emission network. And what I mean by that is there's going to be a lot of other vehicles that have a much smaller carbon footprint that will be either shared or owned, and they deservedly need space on to travel, and it should be very strong connections throughout the city to enable that kind of travel. And I think the second thing, because there's all this on-demand service, smaller vehicles, more shared vehicles, there probably will be a lot less parking in the center of a city for private car storage. And maybe those parking spaces will be repurposed into public space, open space, green space, maybe they're charging stations, maybe they're mobility hubs where people can grab a lot of, access a lot of different kinds of transportation options. Maybe there's new public spaces that are, you know, become icons for the city. I think there's a lot of really interesting things that could happen in a city and still meet transportation demand.
Well, let me follow up on the first point you're making there, and I think all of our guests kind of want to talk about this. You talk about bicycling. So, first of all, I know Uber has authored a letter urging the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure to prioritize safety of vulnerable roadway users such as bicyclists, but also scooter riders, pedestrians, through various programs. And we know that the number of people in this country bicycling on a daily basis, bicycling to work, bicycling out of necessity is going up, but some of the infrastructure hasn't kept pace. And last year, I want to cite one of my colleagues' work, Brett Dahlberg did a series of extensive reporting on bicycling here in Rochester, and reported that in 2011, over 60 miles of bike lanes were added to Rochester's roadways, but he reported that those bike lanes are often now filled with parked cars. The city has no way to track where or when it's happening, and that has left a lot of people wondering, is it possible for Rochester to be multimodal, at least right now? Are we seeing that kind of thing in a lot of places, Shinpei, where even when you're getting the infrastructure, cars will park there, cities don't enforce it that much, or are you seeing change?
Yeah, it's a chicken-egg question in some ways, but I think the real issue is not just the number of miles of bike lanes, but where are they placed? Where are they connecting people to where they want to go? Is it easy to get there? Are there gaps in that network that make it really hard to travel conveniently? I think that, and it's not just the bike lanes, it's also bicycle parking. And I think, you know, the more that you can also think about reducing parking for private cars, the more that you're going to induce a choice where people can feel like they can bike. So, you know, the city of Paris, when they actually had put in a lot of bike lanes in advance of their bike share system. And the bike lanes, they had a very similar issue where they saw that the bike lanes weren't being used as heavily as they hoped. The bike share system, which really made it convenient for people not to figure out how to park their bike or worry about their bike being stolen or have to carry their bike around the entire day. They could just do one leg at a time on a bicycle. That bike share system really helped increase use of the bike lane network, and that made all the difference. So it's a bit of a both issue when you're trying to think about getting people into bicycles, but it's completely doable.
Well, let me ask our guest in the studio. And Maria, I know you're familiar with that reporting from last year. Was that discouraging to see that, you know, here's a city that's added bike lanes, and there are some wonderful people working for the city of Rochester on, you know, planning for the future and increasing what should be access, and yet you still see parked cars, you see sort of, a system that, I don't want to be overly critical, but didn't seem to be penalizing people for parking in bike lanes. Was that discouraging, or how do you feel about that?
Well, yes, it is discouraging, but I think there's a huge education component that goes with it, and there is the enforcement component. We still prioritize cars over any other use, and until we start to get serious about that, then people will know that they can just leave their truck in the middle of the bike lane.
That's chicken and an egg thing that Shin Pei's talking about, you know, sort of.
A little bit, but the other thing is that we really don't have a complete system of connected bike, you know, safe bikeways, mm-hmm. and it would be like, how many people would use cars if the street started nowhere and ended nowhere and didn't pick up again for miles and miles down the road in mm-hmm. another location? I mean, if you don't have a connected system, it doesn't work. And so we can't knock people for not using it, because how do you land in the middle of East Avenue and depart off University just out of nowhere? I mean, the bike lanes come and they go, and they're not totally connected because we're working at it incrementally. So that part I understand. But okay. The value of having a connected system would really make it more usable.
Okay. Jason?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're going to have this upcoming year, you're going to see pedal assist e-bikes legalized. You can finally get, say, e-scooters legalized. And I think we're going to see a whole, there's a lot of pent-up demand for these systems, and we're probably going to see a lot more people this summer riding them, either a bike that's easier to pedal because they don't have to do effort up and down a hill, or just an e-scooter because they're so convenient. And I think, I'm hoping that will be kind of like this turning point. You know, right now you might have a car parking, blocking a bike lane, and maybe two or three bicyclists are inconvenienced, especially in the winter, but now you're going to have 20, 30 people trying to get around, especially downtown. And I think we're probably going to see what we need to see as far as a push for a better connectivity.
And connectivity is one thing, but in a moment, I want to turn back to Shin Pei and ask about the City Mobility Campaign talks about mobility infrastructure legislation. It's one thing, Jason, to say, okay, there's going to be new lanes for this. What is true infrastructure that's not just for the automobile? What's that look like to you?
Infrastructure would be like the more bike share stations, that kind of thing. A lot of just bicycle racks, for one thing. Like Shin Pei talked about, having a place to park could be a thing. We would like to see, we have very, very busy bus routes, especially on the west side, Dewey, mm-hmm. Lake Ave. Those buses are full all the time. They have to pass up passengers all the time just because they're at capacity. So even when we talk about infrastructure, I think we are getting to the point we want to start discussing a streetcar, just because we even need a bigger vehicle than maybe a 60-foot bus can provide. And then things like amenities along the side of the road, too. Just better shelters, better heated shelters, more sidewalks, better cleared sidewalks, that
better
kind of thing.
Yeah, we're going to come back to RTS on the question of infrastructure in a second. Let's stay with that with Maria, though. What's the infrastructure look like when a city is serious?
The simplest thing we could do is have better maintenance of our sidewalks and bike lanes. Just we have winter every year here. It's not going to change. Just coming up with a solution for making walkability actually be possible is a huge step forward.
We did a whole hour on whose responsibility it is to plow sidewalks and the frustration that people feel. I understand that. I mean, we live in a car-dominant society. Well, if you don't have a car, and we got 6 inches of snow last night, and nobody's taken on the sidewalks. How frustrating it must be for people, for parents, for anyone trying to get to work, for people who are elderly or people with disabilities. That can be really, really frustrating. I think people don't always know whose responsibility it is, and that communication is one thing. But you're highlighting, at the very least, a better job citywide of that.
Absolutely. It's something that we can find a solution for, and we really should. This morning I found someone walking in the middle of Monroe Avenue over a bridge. It's dangerous for everybody.
Because of the sidewalks. Yeah. Shinpei, what does real transportation infrastructure look like? And with bicycles, but with everything?
Well, I think about the street, surface transportation. It comprises the biggest majority of public space for any city, thinking about sidewalks and streets. And so I just think about that experience. If you center a person and that person who's traveling through the city in that experience of the street, and you start to build out what would they need along the way, how would they get from place to place, how would they have that freedom of not having to, you know, bring along whatever vehicle it is, but have a lot of different choices. That's the kind of infrastructure I imagine. So I would echo a lot of what Jason and Maria had mentioned, and in terms of, you know, even the parking, the amenities, seating. I think that thinking through the experience of a person who needs to move, what would they need along that journey? That's the kind of infrastructure system I would imagine. And you know, in places there's going to be a need for moving a lot of people at once, and maybe it's at certain times of the day, and there's lots of different solutions now available to make that happen.
Let me get an email as I turn back to Julie Boese from RTS, from Michael, who says, I'm 67 years old and retired. I live on a side street between East and Park. You used to be able to get a monthly bus pass for under $60. Taking the bus seems like a great idea in the good weather, but looking out my window, I see icy sidewalks, and it's a bit of a walk to East and Park to the bus stop, and I certainly wouldn't do it in the dark. Plus, the bus shelters aren't dug out in the wintertime. I feel so sorry when I see someone in a motorized wheelchair having to use the street because of impassable sidewalks. Other than the price, there's no incentive to use the bus system. That's from Michael. What would you say to Michael?
So I guess I would start by saying that so that bus pass is still available. It's $56 a month. Mm-hmm. Our intention right now with our new system is to have the routes run more frequently and to make them more convenient for people. So we're hoping that they're going to get even more value out of their, you know, daily or weekly or monthly bus passes. I do know that there are issues with the shelters not being cleaned out. So unfortunately, it has been the responsibility of the property owner to do that. So RTS does clear out the bus shelters that are on any property that we own, but we do not go around the city and clear out all of the bus shelters. We look for the property owners and the city to do that. So I guess I would just say that with a system that's spread all across the entire county with over 150 bus shelters and, you know, 50 bus routes and everything that we try to do, I think that with the resources that we have, we do the best we can to make sure that we're providing the best service that we can to the community. And in some, you know, some situations, we're going to need some assistance from property owners, business owners, the city, to be able to make that convenient for people to use.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. And this is Bonnie in Rochester next. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, I'm going to take up on some of what was just said, but first, the idea of free buses. There was a program on some NPR or something recently about there was one in Kansas, and I think it was New Jersey. I'm not sure about that, but it was a man who was there talking about. And what they did is they started out by having certain routes that became, you know, the longer routes that became free first. And then they expanded it, and they got, you know, they've gotten very good results from that. So free buses, and the main reason is it may be thinking that's to help people that are, you know, don't have much money, which that's also true. But really, the motivation is to get people to use the bus more. And I think once you kind of begin to see some of that, there's a better chance people will use it. The second thing is, as a person who uses a bus and walks almost all the time, I cannot find the words to say how frustrating it is to constantly, with these weather changes, more moisture in the air, a lot of ice, Nothing is worse than ice with water on top of it as it melts and nobody cleans it off. To think that, especially in, I think in places where there's a lot of rental, to think that landlords who are not being fined for cleaning off the sidewalk and it's left up to tenants is like a joke. It is. If you walk around the city, as I do, and you see in the last, you know, February has been kind of one of those months with a lot of snow and ice and stuff, and there are, you look, I don't think there's been one street in some of these areas that's been cleaned off. I'm sorry, not street, sidewalk. Until it just melts off. And then one side of the street will get the sun, the other side won't. But it is so dangerous walking on the on ice. Snow's a little bit easier, but we've had a lot of ice. And then the snow gets on the ice, and the water gets on the ice. And instead of when it gets slushy, the city, which is the only one that's going to do it, is the city coming around and, you know, clearing off those sidewalks, they don't. They just wait, and then it freezes at night. And, you know, anybody, no wonder people don't want to walk. I mean, only people that are stupid like me that say this is what you have to do to help the environment are doing it. So that is such a fundamental problem, and we need to do something about it rather than doing nothing. And no tenant who lives in a place with six or seven other apartments, what are we supposed to do? Yell up to tenant, you number one in apartment number one, it's your turn to clean off the sidewalk of ice. That's not going to happen.
Bonnie, thank you. Maria, Jason, here in Rochester in our studios here, I know we've talked about that, but that's a lot of frustration. So, again, is this a sort of a city first situation, Maria?
Well, when we're talking about infrastructure, so our first speaker in last year's series was Gil Peñalosa, who's a big proponent of walkability and believes that walkability is one of the best things that we can do to revitalize our urban centers. And what he showed were there are policies in cities across the world that prioritize clearing the sidewalk to an exceptional degree. And they do that before they do the roadways. Imagine that. I don't think it'd be easy for us to get there because we are so focused on the car. But to contribute some more resources and figure out very seriously, work towards a solution, because that is a consistent problem in giving people access to the other forms of transportation that could be available to them if only we had decent sidewalks.
Jason?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of equity issues involved about how quickly we prioritize getting streets cleared, but we don't focus on sidewalks a lot. I think even like when I look at my property tax bill, you know, there's two line items. There's clearing the road part, which is X amount of dollars per frontage of your property line, and clearing the sidewalk, which is Y amount of dollars per frontage of your property line. And the sidewalk is half the amount that we charge for the street. And part of me thinks, well, you know, not to be that guy that says raise taxes, but as a property owner, I would mind seeing my taxes raised if it meant, hey, after they plow the sidewalk, maybe they come through another vehicle that puts salt or something else down to keep that ice under control. And I think that's something we should talk about is how much are we spending on each of these things, and we need to be more equitable about different modes.
Well, speaking of accessibility, here's a question from a listener, and let me kick it to Shinpei Tai, who is joining us and will be in Rochester next week as a guest of the Reshaping Rochester series. So listener asked the following, Shinpei. Can you ask about wheelchair accessibility in transit? As cities become more reliant on Uber and Lyft, is there a risk that they cut bus and transit programs that people with mobility needs rely on? Are Uber and Lyft going to be wheelchair accessible in Rochester? Or is there a shrinking accessible transit system and a growing inaccessible transit system? Shinpei.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such a great question. In our future, I think that transportation absolutely has to be accessible to a wide diversity of people, including people who, you know, might need wheelchairs or other things. And actually, this is something that we're really proud of being able to start to make some progress on, where we've been partnering with transit agencies to provide wheelchair accessible vehicles. We definitely need a more holistic approach in it. We can do a lot better, but our early pilots and partnerships have shown really great cost effectiveness for the transit agencies and also reliability in the experience of the rider. So, for example, in New York City, paratransit requires a 24-hour reservation and a two-hour wait window in which the passenger needs to wait for the vehicle to show up. And many times, you know, the vehicle has trouble getting through the street because it's a specific size of a vehicle that needs to do it. So we are really proud to be able to provide that service. But really, there's an issue here where we need some, you know, there needs to be stronger partnerships, because it's a matter of getting the right vehicles. It's a matter of, you know, increasing the supply of those wheelchair accessible vehicles, making sure that drivers are trained and able to handle passengers and can support the passengers. But we've seen a lot of promise, and there's a lot more to do.
Okay, let me turn to Julie Boese from RTS on that.
I just wanted to add that when we do launch our on-demand service in June, all of our vehicles will be wheelchair accessible, so they'll all have lifts. And as all of the RTS drivers are trained in how to load and unload and secure those passengers. So that's one thing that we are proud of, is being able to say that all of the vehicles that we have in our fleet you know, are wheelchair accessible, and we be able to transport those customers. And that is with just the jet. So on regular buses and all of these smaller vehicles that are open to all of the community, in addition to that, any of our customers that qualify for our paratransit service, they are able to ride any of the regular service for free. So there's a lot of accessibility that comes along with the way we've structured our new system.
Let me get Dana in Brighton on the phone next. Go ahead, Dana.
Good morning, Evan. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, wow, thanks. And you got to turn your radio down there, Dana. Do me a favor, just turn that radio down.
Well, I'm upstairs, far away from my radio, so hopefully... Let me step out on the porch to make sure I'm not in an echo. There we go.
Go ahead, Dana.
Anyhow, as far as making it safe for transportation for people on bicycles or anything that goes slow, I have a wonderful 1954 Ford Jubilee tractor, which is about the size of a car. It's not giant, but Wegmans is only a mile and a half. The hardware store is a mile, so I use my tractor to get around. I also ride motorcycles. Until people put down their phones when they're driving, it's just not safe. You can put up barriers or whatever, and if people aren't looking, they don't see you. And yes, I've been scared once or twice out there because people just aren't watching, even when it's very, very visible that you're there. Unless they're watching, they don't see you. So yeah, that's my two cents. And by the way, on the sidewalks, yeah, I fell this morning on the ice, too.
Well, sorry to hear that. And Dana, hey, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate that. Maria, are we sort of doomed with technology on this? I mean, do you think the culture is changing at all with the expectation for as we commute the use of technology?
I don't know. It seems like we're trying to make it simpler and easier for people to be able to use their technology in a safe way. Mm-hmm. But still, we know anything can happen an instant that you take your eyes away. So it really is up to the driver to commit to being, you know, focusing their attention and you know, committing to the drive as opposed to trying to do 5 million things. I have seen amazing things happen in people's cars. I've seen people change, like, their shirt over their head, mm-hmm. or putting on mascara, or even shaving with a razor. So it's just, you know, people think that they have this extra time, and they really need to put all of their attention to driving.
Well, and Shinpei, this is an argument for... you know, moving away from driving your own car. Because if everybody wants to be productive at all times of the day or wants to feel plugged in, I've been on a train before. I love it. I took the Amtrak and loved how productive I was. And I went, why do I drive cars? Well, this is a good example for, and we can sort of joke about it, but it's a safety issue as well, isn't it?
Absolutely.
For sure. I mean, I moved to a city where a lot of people drive, and we chose not to buy a car because of that experience of having that time in our commute to either, if I'm biking, I'm enjoying the weather and the experience of biking. If I'm on a train or a bus, I get to just ride and maybe read or take care of some emails. I actually really treasure that time and have made choices so that I can do that. Not everyone can make those choices all the time. And I think that's really what's great about having transit agencies that are really aware of the riders, having civic organizations that can really provide another perspective from different users, and you know, having everyone come together and work out these solutions. I think it's really from, you know, I'm really excited to see Rochester next week. It sounds like things are moving along in a really great way, honestly.
Well, can you elaborate a little bit on what that might sound or look like to someone from your perspective, having done the work that you've done? If Rochester's really moving along, what sort of earns that recognition?
Well, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of effort on the part of the community to bring together all the different opportunities in front of them in 2020. Thinking, you know, the transit agency adopting, looking beyond, you know, conventional vehicles and rolling stock, and looking at smaller vehicles, and probably having to do a little bit of work trying to make that fit whatever funding or financing program that they have to make that fit, looking at, you know, probably their service area and trying to figure out where, you know, different kinds of things apply. But then also the civic groups, I saw that the bike share system has been really popular. They're very much supported by, I think it's Reconnect Rochester and probably a host of other organizations. And that kind of public support is really great. There's so much going on in terms of big projects that the entire city can rally around, like the Riverside Rock. I think it's the Riverside Project.
Yeah, Rock the Riverside.
Rock the Riverside. The Loop Project. You know, really thinking about the downtown as a destination and all the little ways and big ways that you can continue to do that. So I think, you know, what I'm hearing is a lot of diversity in your approaches. And a diversity that reflects maybe the changing economics and demographics of the city, that accounts for a really, you know, a more greater diversity of the kinds of trips that people want to take. So, for example, you know, transportation planning used to be just about, you know, getting people to the Central Business District during, you know, peak hour being like rush hour commutes. And it sounds like the city's doing a lot to think about, okay, what are the other ways that people are moving around? What are the other things that we need to do? Another big economic development strategy in the past has been trying to hitch a city's future on a single big kind of, you know, showstopper project like a stadium or a convention center. And maybe you have those things already, but you're thinking about other small interventions, placemaking interventions, your neighborhoods, creating places that people want to be. It doesn't have to be a big stadium. It can be other kinds of experiences. And that kind of diversity of experience for the people of Rochester is really promising.
So one more question for Shinpei before we get our only break of the hour, and I'll remind listeners again in a minute when you can attain the talk with Shinpei coming up here. But I'm going to sort of wade into territory where I realize that I'm sort of becoming an uncool old. And I know that I'm maybe sounding naive when I wonder, maybe the culture's changing. Maybe, you know, going back to Dana's call about being concerned about being on the road with people who are on their devices, who are driving cars and texting. I have this sort of this hope that we as a society are in the infancy of using technology, but we're learning to put it down, to put it away. I mean, we've heard tragic stories. I mean, we lose people every day in this country. And there have been tragic stories in every community in the country because of this stuff. So my hope is, as that takes root, we'll get a better sense of it. But then I also think about kids who are becoming adolescents, who become teenagers, who become adults, and they think they're invincible. I mean, I've been there. And so this hope that I have comes from being a 40-year-old, not a 17-year-old. And so maybe, Shinpei, what we have to do is give up the idea of trying to convince, you know, young drivers that they're not invincible when kids are sort of built to think that until they're not. And then maybe move into this idea that driving is sort of gauche. It's uncool. Like, why would you want to drive? You can do so much more when you're not driving. Why do we want a world where you have to drive? That seems like such a burden. Maybe that's a better approach. Or am I just totally uncool?
Well, I mean, the demographics across the country show that the younger population are delaying getting driver's mm-hmm. licenses. They don't want the burden of owning a car for various reasons, but just the idea of ownership is also really different. So I think that, you know, maybe you're onto something, that there is going to be a culture change. And I think people really value experience today. I think they value, rather than possession, they value the experience. They value the experience of, and the freedom of not having to own something, but still be able to get around. And that's something to think about as we plan for the cities of the future.
Jason, I mean, are you the arbiter of cool? I mean, like, what, well, sure, is the culture changing on this?
No, absolutely. I think when I talk to younger people who volunteer for Reconnect Rochester, it's a frustrating thing. Like, the people come to our colleges from Chicago, New York City. They don't have driver's licenses. It's never occurred to them to learn. And then when it comes graduation time, and when it's time to think about maybe settling in Rochester, they don't. They move back because just the idea
they don't own a car.
They don't own a car. They don't want to own a car.
Yeah.
Just the idea of, you know, getting a driver's license when you're 23 or 24, you've kind of settled into, it's not something you want to do. When you're 16, you do, but it can even be a little intimidating, you know? Yeah. And it's just, and we lose out. Those people move home, and when we talk about young people coming to college and not staying, I think it's one of the main drivers.
Interesting. Maria?
So having a car has always represented freedom because it was the only option. But we're learning as we're finding that we have more options, that freedom has expanded. For example, we're excluding a whole number of people from our population to have the freedom to move around, especially kids that are under 16 or 17 or 18. And those that are over 70 or 80, my mom is 80 years old. She doesn't want to drive anymore, but she wants to be able to go out and meet her friends for lunch or go to a program at Jiva in the evening. So we really, if we look at providing more options, expands people's opportunity for freedom, then we can really start to allocate the resources that are needed to make that happen. But in the meantime, until it's uncool to drive, there are there's proven studies that the road design actually can help create a safe environment. So this whole movement towards complete streets and multimodal access has to do with slowing down traffic. And what I often like to mention is that improves the driver's experience as well. Mm-hmm. Being able to move slowly through a neighborhood and being more alert and aware improves their experience. So let's make it better for everybody.
Julie Boese from RTS, is your ridership getting older or younger?
I think that our demographic spans, all the way across from, the high school or the high school kids that we transport for school all the way up through people who are retired into their 60s and 70s. We found that a lot of people that ride the bus have been riding the bus for a long time. They start young and they stick with us throughout their whole life. So I think that we need to make sure that we are addressing that entire span all the way from those younger kids all the way up to older folks who, have retired and still need to get around. I'm hoping that one thing that will help with this is, in the past we've always had this bus system that kind of went everywhere sometimes, once in a while. And so having this kind of new focus starting in June on these areas where we're going to have frequent service, it's going to run 7 days a week all the time. I'm hoping that that will help some people. If you decide that you want to use the bus system and you can locate your home and your work on that frequent system, then you'll be able to get around. And so I'm hoping that that is at least a starting point for us trying to make a more usable bus system for mm-hmm. the community.
Well, as we head for our only break of the hour, we're going to come back and talk about buy-in, because we'll ask all of our guests about this. If this sounds like the future you want in Rochester or whatever community you're listening from this afternoon, you can't just have it overnight. And how do you get buy-in on that? How do you get sort of public leadership in buy-in? How do you get a culture to change? We'll talk about that and more with our guests when we come back. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we're joined by philanthropist and Paychex founder Tom Golisano. He's written a new book titled Built, Not Born. It's about the mechanics of building a successful business. We'll talk to Tom about his strategies and his accomplishments with Paychex. In our second hour, a new exhibit at the Visual Studies Workshop explores perceptions of Black masculinity. Talk with you on Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Next Wednesday night, the event is called A Sustainable Urban Future Through Transportation. It's at 6 o'clock next Wednesday, the 26th of February, at the Gleason Works Auditorium on University. It's free, but they'd be happy to take your donations. The Community Design Center of Rochester hosting their Reshaping Rochester series, and they are bringing in our guest who's with us for the hour, Shin Pei Tai, who is Director of Policy, Cities, and Transportation at Uber, among other hats. She's also the director of the executive director of the Gale Institute, which is a nonprofit dedicated to providing data about the transformation of public spaces. Maria Fergiuelli from the Community Design Center is here with us in studio. Jason Partika is here from Reconnect Rochester. Julie Boese is here from RTS. And I was remarking to during our brief break that I could just read emails all day about sidewalk snow removal. My goodness, people are fired up about this. Mark writes to say, I wonder how many people will join me in a protest walk down Empire to Clifford the next time we get some frozen precipitation that the highway department responds to by saying, well, it's going to melt. All right, Mark, we'll see. And apparently whoever solves this problem will be elected for life, because people are really, really fired up about the question of our sidewalks. And Shin Pei mentioned what our future is going to look like maybe a quarter of a century from now if things are going the way they are. There's a lot of talk about parking. This is a city, Maria, with a lot of above-ground parking and some underground parking and some way above-ground parking. We seem to have a lot of parking, and yet every new project, it seems to me, includes new parking. It's still... Have you seen enough change? I mean, would you like to see new projects come in where they say, you know what, we're good. We got enough of those lots. We could cover many, many football fields with the unused lots. But they do seem to be kind of tied to most of the new projects that I see.
Well, again, it's the only way that we can really get around in a reliable, frequent way. And we are so used to the convenience. I mean, my husband works at home, and he has a car just for the convenience of being able to go when he wants, where he wants. So, changing the culture, understanding that our urban landscape can be much improved when every missing tooth in the streetscape, when you're walking between buildings and there's large parking facility between you, that could have a better and higher use that would contribute to the city in a more meaningful way. So that's what's really exciting about the car sharing and bike sharing programs, the fact that maybe we can start to realize a better and higher use for some of those other spaces that are allocated to parking.
Sure. Jason, I'm looking at a mostly empty big old lot right here. We don't have to go far in the city to see big empty lots. How do you feel about the way the public conversation is happening around new projects, whether it's the filling of the inner loop, the neighborhood of play? There's often still parking attached to that. Does that bother you, or do you think that's just sort of where we are right now?
I'd like to think we're progressing. I think it wasn't that long ago, maybe 10 years ago, where it's just taken for granted that any new development would have parking lot. But now you're seeing people trying to back away with that. There's in our codes and laws, there are parking minimums. Like if you wanted to even build something without a parking lot or a parking space, you couldn't, which is, a sad state of affairs. But I think, during the 2034 plan, we saw a lot of dialogue around that probably wouldn't have happened like back in maybe 2000. The city did try to do something ambitious in the first draft about parking minimums. They had to walk a lot of it back because, you're right. There's still a lot of convincing to do just here in the city about parking minimums. But I think it's something that's talked about more and more, and it's something, people don't want to go through the expense of.
Jason, who's the hardest to convince? I think business community?
I think part of it's the business community. We've seen... part of going on in East Main Street right now, there's an East Main Street redevelopment going on that had like a really good a really great design
nice
with
design.
Protected bike lanes and sidewalks and stuff like that. And even that's starting to be walked back now because there are developers who are trying to redo buildings and they just can't conceive of an idea that there has to be parking. And, we try to push back. It's like, well, five spaces on the street really make or break your business, especially when there's adjacent parking lots all over East Main Street. But yeah, it is. It's really hard for people to conceive of an idea that people might walk to their business.
Okay, Maria, you want to jump in?
Well, yeah, I think it's important for us to convince the normal population because the businesses respond to our demands, and so does City Hall. So if we demand parking and that's what we scream and talk about, that's what they're going to provide you. So interesting thing on East Main Street, they're losing a lane of parking, but they're fighting very hard to preserve a whole lane for turning that can be used occasionally. So why not you know, have preserve the lane of parking and give up the turning lane, because when we slow down the traffic, we can facilitate people moving through the neighborhood in a safer way, and we might not need to reserve that turning lane. So it's all about allocating resources, but I think it's up to the public to start to make those changes and demands.
No, it's so true. I mean, I drove to Glen Edith Coffee on Somerton the other day. There's like 6 parking spaces in their little lot, and I pull in and it's full, and I'm like, oh, I gotta park around the corner on Park Avenue. This is the worst. And then I realized I'm the worst. I'm the problem here. What am I doing? You know, like a short walk around the corner. I took the point there, Maria. I don't want to be part of the problem. But Shin Pei, what's the biggest challenge to getting buy-in, whether it's converting these big empty parking lots and spaces, whether it's, you know, the next wave of community projects won't all have parking tied to it? Who needs to be convinced most for buy-in?
I mean, it is across the board. Maybe a little bit of awareness is helpful in the sense two directions. One, for every car, on average, there's 8 parking spots. And so when you think about that amount of space, it's really quite incredible how much we're dedicating to just storing cars. The second is that parking spaces are actually extremely expensive to construct. And so maybe there are better uses for people, for the developers, for the city, as they think about, you know, what they need to provide in terms of parking. I do think that with parking, the most important thing is that you're providing an alternative to driving. Otherwise, it's really hard to make that argument. And you're basically telling people to give up something for not much of anything else. It sounds like there's a lot going on, though, in terms of alternatives. So, you know, I think that there's, you know, there's some pathways forward here.
Well, and so, Shin Pei, when you talked about, you know, what you're hearing about Rochester, there's Reconnect Rochester. There's definitely a grassroots movement that is really sort of devoted to urbanism. And I think, frankly, in the last couple of years, I really think urbanism through equity as well, or equity through urbanism, which matters. And so you've got this grassroots movement, which is important. But that's, you know, like all movements that kind of start small, it's hard to measure just how big it is. It's strong. It's got a big voice because people care. But how much it has sort of trickled into the general population is hard to measure. How much are you seeing these kind of movements in other cities, and how impactful are those kind of movements?
They can be extraordinarily impactful. I think that, you know, grassroots have really can also have great grass tops advocacy. There was I did some research a few years ago that looked at how innovation in transportation spread in cities, and what were the human factors behind them. And civic organizations are incredibly important to quick adoption by any city. It has to be in partnership with the city. It has to have city leadership. The mayor needs to be on board. City hall needs to be on board. But there can be often public agencies are dealing with a lot of different demands, and they sometimes could benefit from an outside perspective to help move things in one way or another. Often public agencies also are dealing with operational issues, like the issues of today. It's quite common for public agencies to not have the bandwidth or space to think about the future. And I think, you know, Rochester obviously benefited from an agency that was able to do that. But, you know, civic organizations can really think creatively about the future and think beyond, you know, the current policy structures, and think about what sort of things need to be invented, what sort of policy conditions, what sort of public engagement needs to happen. And they can take on those kinds of really interesting questions to build up that public support.
And speaking of policy, one more quick question from a listener. Nick wants to know if it's true. He's hearing that other countries are setting rules that the new automobiles cannot be using fossil fuels in the future. In other words, all electric requirements. Nick wants to know if that's true. Shin Pei, do you know?
I wouldn't say at the national level, but definitely in some cities, especially we're seeing a lot of leadership from European cities. There's things called low emission zones, where there's a cordon around a city and only zero emission or low emission vehicles can enter the center of the city. Uber actually supported the ultra low emission zone in London, and the Clean Air Act. And so I think that there's actually a really interesting partnership that's happening between new technology companies and this vision of the future where it's low emission possibilities.
Well, we appreciate the time this hour, Shin Pan. I know they're excited to see you. Can you give us just a quick 30 seconds on what you're excited to share with guests next Wednesday night in Rochester?
Well, I'm really excited to be visiting the city. I grew up in Syracuse, so I'm really excited to see what has happened in Rochester since I last visited. But what I'll be trying to show is how transportation is one of the biggest determinants of so many different issues that people care about or society cares about, such as health, air and carbon, climate change, and all the opportunities that are in front of us in order to make a more sustainable city.
Shin Pei, we'll see you next Wednesday in Rochester. Shin Pei Tai is the Director of Policy, Cities, and Transportation at Uber and Executive Director of the Gale Institute. Thanks for making the time for us. We'll see you in Rochester.
Thank you very much.
And
look
our thanks as well to our guests here. Maria, what are you, 30 seconds, what are you most excited about for next Wednesday?
Well, I just can't wait for this next lecture. I mean, we're really excited about the whole series, and every new speaker brings a new dimension. So we're really looking forward to seeing Shin Pei, and we're looking forward to having her share her expertise with us.
Jason, do you feel like these conversations are bringing the kinds of ideas that are making change here?
I do. I think the more we talk about it, and I think about the 2034 plan, I saw the word multimodal throughout it, and I think in previous plans, multimodal isn't a word people ever said. Mm-hmm. So I think just giving people the vernacular or the vocabulary and the way to speak about it and envision it really helps a lot.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests here. And Julie, as I mentioned, I know we're going to talk to Bill Carpenter soon on this program. RTS has a lot to share about their plans. Thanks for making it work and being here and part of this conversation today.
Thank you.
Director of Service Planning at RTS, Jason's with Reconnect Rochester. Maria is the Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. Thank you. Have a great event next Wednesday.
Thank you.
And our thanks to the whole team today. Don, working behind the glass, doing extra work for us, but really doing extra work is MRA Stein and Megan Mack. Megan Mack is the engineer and the producer and the everything. I have the microphone. She doesn't get enough credit. Hope you've had a great day, and we will talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.